Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to The Critic Books podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, and this week I'm speaking to Yasmin Cordery Khan. Yasmin is a historian and broadcaster. She is the author of The Great Partition, for which she won the Gladstone Prize, and The Rajah War. Edgware Road is her first novel.
Hi Yasmin, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Cheska, thank you for having me.
So exciting. So we're here to discuss your novel Edgware Road, which we're recording on the Monday, but it comes out this Thursday. And it's quite hard to sum up what your novel is about in a way. It's part mystery, part family drama. It tells in part the story of a father and daughter in both 1987 and 2003. Would you mind telling our listeners a bit more about the plot of the book and about what influenced it when you started thinking about it?
It's about two generations of a Pakistani family. So there's a father who is a first generation migrant from Pakistan, and he's trying to make things work, but he's really interested in money and trying to get rich. So he's the sort of anti-hero of the story, because as you might anticipate, things don't work out quite as he wants them to. And it's twinned with the timeline of his daughter, who's in the noughties and is trying to figure out what happened to him and what he got up to and what he got involved in. So that's how they run parallel to each other. And I suppose, I don't live in London anymore. And I think I really wanted to write a London novel. And it's very much set in London and along the Edgware Road. And that's the kind of heart of the story geographically, but also the 1980s and Thatcher's Britain are really central to the book too.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about the London setting in a way. So it's named after Edgware Road, the tube station, but also the road. And the tube station is not just of passing importance to the story, it's quite central. And Alia travels between her parents from Hammersmith up to the Edgware Road. And Khalid spends a lot of time in the West End and then in Hammersmith along the river. It's almost as if the city is kind of like a character in itself. So did you live in London? Did you live in West London? And then are you writing from experience?
There's a lot of me in the book, of course. And I did grow up in West London, not quite in the same places as the characters, but I did grow up in West London, and it's a place that I've lived on and off over the years. So I know those landscapes quite well. And the Thames has always been really important, and the Tube. And I wanted to try and convey some of that grittiness of the underground and the Tube, and also something of London before it was gentrified, I suppose. There's something about this slightly tough, gritty, dirty London in it, I think, that I hope comes across, which is slightly different to the later way that London has developed and continued to develop in more recent years.
Yeah. Have you read The Lonely Londoners by Sam Selvan?
No, I haven't.
No, I think I read it not too long ago, and when I was reading your book, it just popped up in my head. There are long bus journeys in a kind of gritty London, telling the story of Windrush generation immigrants in London in the first time in the 50s and 60s, which is quite beautiful.
Yeah, there are other books that have had a bearing on it in that sense of thinking about London. And Andrew Levy, of course, with Small Island and that sense of London as a place that migrants arrive to. Also Alan Hollinghurst as well, and I really like The Line of Beauty, and that's obviously a very different sort of glitzy, much more glamorous side of London, but it was also that 1980s sense of new wealth and new money, the yuppies and people kind of living it up alongside all these other kind of social issues that are happening on the ground. So that was one that was in my mind, and other books like London Orbital, and there's things that have definitely kind of made their way into this from different sources.
Now you mention it, you can kind of see the Line of Beauty in its different sides of the Thatcher in the 80s, Notting Hill, Edgware and Hammersmith. Yeah, it's really lovely. So as we've already mentioned, the story is a dual time narrative with Alia and her father. How did you deal with writing, so you've already mentioned a bit, but the difference between 1980s Thatcher London, Thatcherite London, Thatcherite Britain, and then 2003, so post-Blair, the Iran-Iraq war, a lot's going on there. How did you deal with the difference?
It's a good question. I think the 1980s part of the book, there's quite a bit of research. I also I did spend time walking around, taking photographs and thinking about places, especially along the Edgware Road, like the massage parlors and the casinos and the money exchanges. And I was trying to think, you know, when did those places emerge and how did they come about and how much has London changed over that time? So there's a lot of that. But then obviously the noughties part is also set in other places. So there's Karachi in there. And that's another place I've been and spent time in. So I was also drawing on memories of being in Karachi in Pakistan and trying to think of both sides of that migrant experience, both halves of that journey and what it must be like to come from one to the other and vice versa.
Yeah, so it's London, Oxford and Karachi is the kind of, there's a very powerful moment when Alia, so the daughter, goes to Karachi to try and to meet her extended family, some for the first time, not for the first time at all, but the difference between her experience having grown up as a second generation migrant in London and then her family is it's quite different, isn't it? The way that they interact with each other is very different.
Yeah, I think she kind of is a lone ranger and she's an independent person and she's very on her own and doing things individually, and then she's thrown into this family context where you have that kinship network of cousins and aunts and uncles and everybody's there and they kind of own her in a way because she's part of that kinship network. And I think that you get a sense, I hope, that she's trying to deal with that struggle between, on the one hand she says, I'd quite like to go and stay in a hotel by myself, you know, she'd quite like to go and just be a tourist and look around, but she can't, you know, she's got all these network of obligations to people, and that's one of the things that obviously breaks down for people when they arrive in London. It's not quite the same, they haven't got that same proximity to all those people who are involved in every little bit of your business, you know, kind of pay attention to everything, what you're wearing, what you're eating, who you're friends with, everything. So, you know, I think it was trying to show that contrast between that individualism and that collective experience as well, I think.
Yeah. And she is teaching, she's a stipendiary lecturer or in English at Oxford. You have taught, or do you still teach, I'm not quite sure, in Oxford as well. Is that another part of you that's in Alia?
It's funny because I do teach in Oxford, but I don't, my experience of Oxford is really different to my characters. She's in a very precarious stage of employment. She's a young lecturer. And I think a lot of people in academia now would talk about how hard it is to get into working in universities and just how different the image of Oxford is from the outside and then what people experience when they're on quite low salaries, living in poor accommodation and struggling to publish. And so that's her, she's very much sort of precarious academic who's just emerged out from the doctorate and is really trying to make her mark on the world but doesn't quite know how to do it. And she's in an old Oxford college, so there's all the trappings of an old college with the chapel and the dining hall and the dealing with the old dons and everything. My experience of Oxford is completely different because I teach mature students. I teach part-time mature students and I've been there for a really long time and I don't you know have that much in common in relation to Alia, but I understand that situation, I think, yeah, just from being there for a long time.
So one theme that goes throughout the novel is gambling, and much of how Khalid structures his life is a kind of gamble, whether it's on like slot machines, horses, or larger gambles, which may or may not pay off as the novel shows. What drew you to writing about that kind of like urge for luck and chance?
Well, I think also I was conscious of the fact that Khalid is a Muslim character. He's a Pakistani by birth, and there's a lot of fictional portrayals of Muslims and Pakistanis at the moment that rely on tropes to do with religion and radicalization or terrorism, or think about their experiences in terms of those kinds of events that have happened since 9/11. And I really want to show a totally different side to that part of the world and to that migrant experience, which is much more rooted in money, actually, and trying to get ahead and socioeconomic circumstances, where really making it big or making it it's really about that sort of sense of chance, but also being taking a gamble, taking a risk. And the whole kind of act of migration to me seems like a risk, like a gamble, where you're staking your life on something. So I just wanted to put that emphasis in there. And I really like Sanjeev Sahota's book, Year of the Runaways. And that's similar in the sense that it's also thinking about Asians coming to Britain, but not the thing that's really motivating them is just making a living. That's the primary thing that we see. And they, you know, in his book, they're working on building sites and working in fried chicken restaurants. But it's just that sort of everyday drama that is different to perhaps thinking about it through that religious lens.
Yeah, and I think it's so interesting that Khalid is working for the Playboy Club, Hugh Hefner's London Playboy Club, which I'm not sure when it shut down, but I think it definitely wasn't after the 90s. And it's a very like moment in time of 80s London to imagine that was still there.
Yeah, it's quite hard to imagine nowadays, you know, the gender politics of these bunny girls and the Playboy Club. But that, you know, there's a sort of international glamour about it, wasn't there? And you know, I think that moment in the late 70s, early 80s, and when the book begins, there's a real, you know, that is seen as success to be driving a flashy car and going to the casino and having a beautiful woman on your arm. And that was a kind of universal idea of success, which has just changed such a lot, I think, since then. But the, you know, there's a scene where Khalid is trying to go into work and there are these feminists on the street protesting about the bunny girls and about the Playboy Club, and you get the sense, yeah, the world is, this isn't going to last, you know, this whole thing of these women running around with pom-poms on their you know, as tails, is just not going to last.
There's one line where doesn't one of the feminists asks why would you want to compare a woman to an animal or something? He goes, what a bizarre question, I never thought of that.
Exactly.
Yeah, a completely different world. For a large part of the second novel, the second part of the novel, there's a kind of drama and mystery which is set against the backdrop of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, and there is an MP, a Labour MP, who initially is trying to find out about what turns out to be quite a big scandal, and then a lot of the men in the book are involved in the bank. It's a true story, isn't it? Could you tell us a bit more about it?
Yeah, it's a completely true story. BCCI, which is the bank, folded in 1991. It was shut down overnight very rapidly, and a lot of people all over the world, including in Britain, lost deposits and lost money when the bank was closed. And so I did quite a lot of research reading up about that and the inquiries into that banking scandal. And there'd been noises about it right through the late 1980s. But when it closed, it was as if it was a great big shock, as if nobody knew that it was dodgy and that it was caught up in all sorts of international political and financial scandal. But actually, there was a lot of information available about that. So I was kind of intrigued by how people turned a blind eye to that, and also how it foreshadows the later banking crisis that occurs in more recent years, you know, in 2007. So it was a, you know, it's tricky to write about banking. It's not an easy thing to write about, because you're really just writing about numbers. So I wanted to try and make that banking crisis real without it bogging down the plot, so that you kind of see how something that's really abstract and to do with numbers and banks actually really has a physical impact on characters and on their lives.
Yeah, it really works. You really do feel it. And there's quite an emotional, like, it's kind of like quite a tense moment where the MP, who has been writing questions to try and find out from the Chancellor of the Exchequer and other people in government, and then retracts his questions because he realizes he doesn't want to put his foot in it. But
I think there was a real you know, there's a real drama like that around a bank. But if you read about it in nonfiction or you read about it in a newspaper article, it seems so abstract and it's so complicated and there's so many different people involved that we feel that it's somehow detached from ourselves. Whereas if you put it in fiction, it becomes more visceral because you see, yeah, actually these flows of money can be cut off, or they can affect all sorts of things in people's actual lives and actually become a life and death matter too. So you know, that's what I was thinking about, and I think it's a really, in itself, that whole BCCI story is an incredible story that not many people now think about.
Yeah, and the way you describe the building in central London as being so glamorous and amazing, it is kind of like a reincarnation of the Playboy Club in a weird way, that kind of temple to money and chance and success.
Yeah, and the fact that people can take a risk on banking as well, in a way, it's a lot of trading, and banking is just gambling too. So it's you know, Khalid might be on a machine in the pub putting his 50 pence pieces in, but it's, you know, how different is that from these people sort of rolling over huge numbers in the city? So there's sort of some parallels there, I think, too.
Yeah, definitely. So as you mentioned, quite a bit of the novel takes place in Karachi, and Alia's father is Pakistani and her mother is English, and when she returns to Karachi, there's some sense that she's different from this extended family because of her dual heritage. And what was it like writing about that?
I think there's more and more people now certainly in London, you know, being dual heritage is just so common. It's just the norm even. And yet I don't think we have that many stories that think about the complications and layers of that. Hanif Qureshi was doing it, of course, years and years and years ago. But it's that sort of, you know, belonging to two places and all the riches that brings, but also the kind of the insider-outsider status that you have with that dual heritage. It's being on I think it makes an anthropologist out of people. You know, it's sort of, you're kind of on the inside, but you're also kind of looking at it through different eyes too. And you know, it's amazing now how in Britain we just have this generation of kids, my kids included, who just feel that they have a link to so many different parts of the world, and I love that. So I kind of wanted a character who embodied that a bit too, but she's not entirely easy with it. She's not entirely, I think if she, you know, nowadays, I think if you had a character, completely contemporary character, she'd just be completely comfortable with that. But part of this is about Alia finding her feet with that and becoming able to move through those different worlds.
She is quite literally trying to find her father as well. She was very young when,
Yeah. And it's not telling any secrets that he's died in a mysterious way. So she's literally trying to find out what's happened to him and how he's died and where he was when he died, you know. So she's trying to piece it all back together again. So that's the sort of mystery thread running through it. And so of course, yeah, she has to sort of work out her own relationship to her own family and her past and her own identity, I think.
I don't want to ruin any of the plot for people who haven't read it, but I loved how fierce she was by the end, and that kind of huge confrontational moment where she asks for basically what is her inheritance, in a sense, to have it back. And it's just really beautifully done. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I didn't write it like that initially, actually. And I rewrote some of the ending, and my great editor, you know, I talked to her about it and we thought about it, and then I just got this big rush of energy and wrote the ending, and I think it was much improved for her, for really thinking about what she wanted at that moment.
It's a very tense moment, but it's very brilliantly done. Thank you so much. I enjoyed reading it so much. It's really lovely. Thank you
very much, and thanks a lot for your questions and your support. Really appreciate it.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.